Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Welcome again to The Hobcast. It's episode number 7, and this week we'll be speaking to Jem Butcher, one of our cover designers, extremely experienced and incredibly talented. We'll be talking to him about cover design and all things like that. But first of all, let's introduce ourselves. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And we are Hoback Books, or at least the directors and co-creators of a small independent UK publisher of the following.
Mystery.
Thrillers.
Crime.
And suspense. And this podcast is designed to take you into our world, some of the pleasures, the frustrations of running a small independent book publisher and creative business in this difficult time of the pandemic. But things are starting to lift. Yesterday, I had my jab.
He did. He got jabbed.
And I felt it as well. No, it was an extremely slick and, I think, personable experience. Yes, they were trying to get people through quickly, but nonetheless, I felt really well looked after. So I'd like to commend the staff at the Civic Hall in Poynton in Cheshire, who gave me my jab. I had the Pfizer jab, which has turned out not given me many side effects, apart from a sore, deltoid, I think.
A deltoid,
yeah. I had the pleasure of the guy who was running the desk where I got jabbed said, oh, that's a fine deltoid. So I'm still flushed with pride that I have a fine deltoid.
Any excuse to mention his fine deltoid since then, he has taken it up.
Well, wouldn't you? I mean, the rest of me sort of sags, flops, doesn't work, but my deltoids are fine.
How about your brain?
Yeah, that has been a tricky beast this week as well. We'll talk about that in a minute. So this week, let's get cracking into the news. First of all, we launched a book. So that was Daria's Daughter. We spoke to Linda Huber last week, and there's been a great reaction to that interview and the candor of which she told us about her process and that brilliant thought that once you publish a book, it's the reader's book. It's not her book anymore. I love that. That's going to be one of those things that I'm going to take with me throughout this publishing journey.
Yeah, I mean, Daria's Daughter is done sort of beyond our expectations already. She was, they have the hot new releases chart on Amazon, and I think she reached number 9 in the psychological fiction, which, you know, we were stunned. It was brilliant.
Yeah, pre-sales were good, and they've carried on. And I think people, oh, Aki, here you come. Do you mind?
At least she hasn't got a mouse this time.
That's true. Okay, we'll talk about Daria's Daughter again in a moment, but just to tell you what we're talking about, we had our very first mouse brought in by the cat this morning at this new place that we now live in. And she was so proud of herself, but of course, it was horrific. You know, you're in a Sunday morning, you're half dead to the world, and suddenly she's there meowing away with a rodent in her mouth.
So you say it was horrific. Was it horrific for you, lying in bed while I ran after the cat and locked her in the bathroom? And
well, technically, whose cat is it?
I think she thinks she belongs to you just as much as me now.
She belongs to no one. She just happens to bunker down here. But anyway, that was rodent gate earlier, but it shows she still got it at the age of 12.
Yeah, we were wondering, weren't we?
Yeah, we were beginning to wonder, you know. Like the rest of us, she's getting older. However, let's go back to Daria's Daughter. It has sold really well, and that's not way to judge it, because as Linda said, as long as two people enjoy it, that's great. But the reviews have been fantastic too, so congratulations to Linda, our latest Hoback author published into the world, and you know, we look forward to the success. Now, don't forget, if you want to access any of the paperback copies of our books, then go to our website, www.hoback.net, and the shop there, and there is a discount code that is mentioned at the end of the program. Use that for 20% off. I'll tell you what it is. It's Hobcast 20 in capital letters.
and you'll get 20% off. So go there for Daria's Daughter and our other offerings from the following: Wendy Turbin,
Anthony Dunford,
and Robert Dawes,
Lewis Hastings.
Anyone else we missed? A.B. Morgan, and others to come, including Malcolm Hollingdrake, who will be featured in the interview because it is Jem Butcher's design that will adorn the two new books that are coming out next month and in May. And that is the Merseyside Crime Series, books 1 and 2. And that's one of the areas we've been working on this week. But it has been a really busy week. Let's touch on the news first. What's caught your eye most of all?
Well, a couple of things, and they might be a little bit quirky and sort of they're related to publishing, but that's the sort of thing that usually catches my eye rather than the big news. I was just browsing the bookseller just now, and I noticed Hillary Clinton is entering into the thriller genre writing field, not published by us, of course. Pan Macmillan have just signed her.
No, we had to turn her down. We didn't feel that she was speaking with authority, and you know, that's, she has an experience. I think this is an important thing. Write what you know. And Hillary, you know, what do you know about being Secretary of State of the United States? The answer is not much.
But it raises an interesting question, doesn't it? Do politicians or people who've had sort of long and interesting political careers, do they make good thriller writers?
Sometimes. Well, I think for me, the best of the bunch is Michael Dobbs, who wrote House of Cards and also some brilliant books I love about Churchill, sort of fictionalizing the wilderness years of Churchill's. You know, he was cast out by the Tory party before the war and was talking about, you know, the threat that Nazi Germany played. No one would listen to him because they thought he was a crank by this point. Those are great books. And the House of Cards, well, it was obviously the inspiration behind the next Netflix series, and he was the executive producer on that. But the BBC series is the one that in this country everyone remembers, with Ian Richardson playing Francis Urquhart. And yeah, so, but that's not a political figure of the scale of Hillary Clinton by any means.
No, but was it Jean Le Carré who said, you know, write what you know, and if you've got experience in whatever it is, whether it's being a spy or being a politician, write what you know and you can do it.
Well, Bill Clinton wrote with James Patterson, The President's Missing, I think it was called. I read that. And, you know, like a lot of James Patterson's work, which feels like, you know, I'll do the, you know, Bill, I'll write, you know, the synopsis and the beats, mm-hmm. and you fill in the blanks. And there were some interesting elements, you know, about presidential life and escape routes from the White House and stuff like that, which is quite interesting. But in the end, I think it failed. I think, you know, I wasn't. Yet again, it was another president who's an ex-Special Forces guy. Aren't they all, or ex-CIA? I mean, they all seem, in films nowadays, they all can fly a fighter jet like they did in Independence Day or stuff like that. Or, you know, Harrison Ford's in Air Force One can suddenly turn his hand to killing terrorists with his bare hands, stuff like that. I mean, I'm just getting a bit cynical about this sort of stuff. But, you know, publishers know what they're about. When they get a name of that scale, you know, several hundred thousand people are going to buy that, if not millions.
Mm.
Simple as that. And, you know, fair enough. I'm not going to complain too much. But I sometimes wonder, you just don't know where the line is. And I think also there was, if you think about, you know, I think Tony Blair, has he written a thriller at some point? I can't remember. But it is one of those things where, yeah, you've got a lot of knowledge, but it doesn't mean you're an artist, and it doesn't mean you're a great writer. You're certainly great at fiction if you're a politician.
Boris, if you're listening, send in your submission to hobeckbooks@gmail.com and we will consider it.
Out of hand. Right. The thing that caught my eye this week was some positive news for the UK. One of the things that obviously went by the wayside last year across the world were festivals, physical presence at festivals. They went online, some of them. But it's not the same, is it? I mean, there's nothing beats going to a weekend-long or four-day festival and meeting your heroes and heroines in the author community and getting the book signed and all that sort of thing. It looks like the Harrogate Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival is going to be going ahead. I think I probably got the title wrong, but that's in midsummer here in the UK in Yorkshire. And that's one of the favourite festivals for the authors who absolutely love it. I know that, you know, we've got Robert Dawes has been a guest there in the past, one of our authors. I think Malcolm Hollingdrake also, who writes about Harrogate, of course, and Adam Croft, a good friend of the program, who will be joining us before very long, I'm sure, and indeed Matt Brolly. They've all been guests there, and sort of our uncle figure in this business is Peter James, who has been an influence on many of our authors. He's also a regular there. So that is going ahead, it seems, in physical form. So you can, they haven't put tickets on sale yet, but they made the announcement this week that it will be going ahead. They haven't said who's going, but we really want our Hoebeck authors to be there.
Oh,
so
it would be brilliant.
Well, we're going to lobby. So
we'll nag them until they let us.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to absolutely thump them until they let us in. But maybe they'll take us for 2022. So that was a good positive piece of news. I believe also that Crime Fest in Bristol will be going ahead, perhaps. And, you know, it may mean that all the festivals start to open up. That would be wonderful.
And it's going to change the way we run our business, because we've only really operated during a pandemic. So we did go to the Morecambe and Vice Festival just before we at the beginning. And, you know, we talked about this before. We sort of felt a bit imposterish because we didn't have any books. We didn't have any authors at that point. And so the next time we go to a festival, it'll be completely different feel for us, I think.
We'll have to take the cat if we do go.
At this rate, yeah.
And no one will want to meet us or our authors. It's just
they'll just go, oh, what a cute cat. How lovely she is.
Well, yeah. We must tell the listeners a little story what happened to us this week. So Rebecca and I went for a tiny weeny walk just to talk through a couple of things that were bothering us this week. Lots of things were bothering us this week, but... it was a beautiful afternoon. We went for a walk and the cat followed us as if it was a dog.
She does this frequently.
Yeah, meowing away 100 yards behind us. Eventually, we managed to shake her off. And
we normally have to sprint for a bit.
Yeah. So we're sitting on our favourite bench, very close to the house here, overlooking the fields. It was beautiful. And we met a couple who were looking for directions for the bridle way that runs through the estate we live on. And so we pointed them in the right direction. They said, oh, we've just met a stray cat. Very vocal.
And I said, it's not white, ginger and black by any chance, is it?
Oh, yes. So Aki had made it out that she was a stray and she'd been fed dog biscuits.
Yeah. So
this lovely couple had fed her dog biscuits because they were concerned about, you know, her starving. Well, trust me, if you saw Aki at the moment, she's carrying a little extra weight.
Yes, yeah, a bit of a middle-aged pouch on her at the moment, isn't there?
So there is.
She is so not starving.
And so not quiet either. She's all over the interview coming up with Jem Butcher, which is a pain. Have you got anything else in the news that you wanted to talk about?
There was just one other thing. I think we've mentioned this before, but as a company, we would like to give back something to the community in some way when we're in a position to. You know, we're not at the moment, but, you know, it's sort of like a long-term goal of ours. And I was reading about the Bookchade charity, who have just finished building some housing, which they're going to offer to sort of postgraduates who want to work in publishing, so they can afford to do internships in the city.
Oh, that's good.
But, you know, be able to afford to live in this housing, so the sort of flats and apartments that they're providing. And I just think that's wonderful, personally. I think it's great.
Yeah, that is a good, great step forward. I think that is one of the impediments to entering the publishing industry. Aki's now clawing her way at our furniture. You can probably hear that
crackle.
Excuse
me a moment. Aki!
Yeah, well, that told her. Oh, she's on the sofa, very close to our booth now. She really is an attention seeker. So, that is a great idea. And we, in the future, will hope to offer internships too. We actually have had people approach us, but we're just not at that stage yet. But, you know, wait and watch this space and we'll move on. That. Now, normally we would talk about how many words I've written. I think we'll do it now, if we may.
Yes. I think this is a difficult topic, actually. But, okay, how many words have you managed this week?
A big fat zero. And I set out with aspirations to work every day and that sort of thing. And this is where I want, you know, indulge me, please, dear listeners, because, you know, to be honest with you, I do suffer from depression. And it struck me quite hard this week. For at least 2 days, I was pretty much knocked out of action. I was unable to communicate for large chunks of the time, and I was in my own little world, curled up, often with my head in my hands. It's not easy, and it's certainly not a background, a backdrop for creativity, or indeed some of the other work we do. It's very hard for me to find that level of concentration. But there were reasons for this, which I don't really want to go into in terms of, you know, wider family stuff. But everything sort of conspired, I suppose, to send me into this spiral. And it was a sharp reminder of what that can feel like and how destructive it can be in terms of just not being able to do anything. So we had a circuit breaker day off yesterday. For the first time in months, we took the day off and we didn't go with our laptops and we didn't answer emails terribly much.
No, I mean, I answered a few on the phone, but I worked out it. The last day I'd not done any work whatsoever was Boxing Day. So it was quite a long time ago.
Yeah. And, you know, we're on the verge. Well, it's March when this podcast goes out. So it's very difficult. I think one of the things about running your own creative business is that there's always a long list of things that need doing. And the temptation is to do them and chip away at them every single day. But actually, that is counterproductive. And I think I reached my threshold. And I think you've been reaching your threshold, to be perfectly honest, in the last couple of weeks, where, you know, it just has felt insurmountable. But things feel a little different now. We've had a day taking in the air and seeing some sunshine and things like that.
I think it's quite remarkable, really, because it was just a day. And I did dip in and out of email on the phone and Twitter. But when you're forced to stop and let your brain sort of catch up on itself a little bit, then I do feel so much better today. I've done some work today, but although I still have a big to-do list because I've been doing lots of freelance work as well as working on Hoback, but it seems more manageable somehow because my brain is sort of going at a much easier pace than the sort of frantic, oh, I need to do this and this and this and this.
Yeah, and it's difficult to see it coming when you're at that sort of pitch. And it's really difficult to stop being at that, working at that pitch and doing so. I mean, I do find it easier to take time away from the work than you do. But this way, I just couldn't do it some days. And that in itself makes it worse.
But I think it's important to point out, though, that there's a major difference in the way we respond to stress. When I'm stressed, I tend to almost use work as an escapism. And when you're stressed, you can't work. You know, you find the work too overwhelming. So there's that sort of, it's quite an important difference, but it makes it look like I'm more busy than you or I'm coping better than you, but I'm not necessarily. It's just we deal with it in different ways.
Yeah, I think we've both spent time this week picking each other up off the floor occasionally.
Just different times to each other, which is very useful, actually.
You know, there's no magic solution to this. And as I say, you know, people will say, oh, exercise will help, drink more water, whatever it might be, find your space, take time out, meditate, all sorts of things. I've tried them all and indeed, you know, taken stuff for it. But it can sometimes just overwhelm.
And it was a full moon this week, and a special moon. I think it was called the snow moon, in fact. So it was a very powerful full moon. And I do have a little bit of belief that that does affect the mind.
Yeah, well, it probably does. Okay, let's move on to our interview. And we were delighted a few months ago when we contacted Jem Butcher, who is a really experienced designer. And he started working with us. And so far, we have 6 covers, Hoback covers, have come from his design studio. And Jem has designed books for Lewis Hastings and Malcolm Hollingdrake. We will have examples of his work on the website when this podcast goes live, so you can have a look at a sort of gallery of the images. But he really is incredibly talented and very experienced. So just to mention where Jem has worked in the past, for publishers like Longman, Doring Kindersley, Random House, Transworld, and he was the art director of Simon & Schuster in the UK for 6 years. So he knows what he's talking about, and he knows what he's doing with a cover design. But for the last 13 years, he has been working as a solo freelance designer from his base in London. That's where we joined him. Jem Butcher, thanks so much for joining us on the Hopcast. It's you're down in London, that's right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Finsbury Park. Well, Stroud Green, really.
Right. And so you're right in the epicenter of where pretty much it's all been happening in terms of coronavirus.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a dose myself. So,
So we're extremely lucky to be speaking to you then. But then again, you're fit, healthy, and a bit younger than us. So it's great to have you aboard.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. So let's, I've given you, given the listeners a brief précis of some of the things, your journey to where you are now, but perhaps you put some flesh on that in terms of moving from learning graphic design at college and becoming a book designer. What took you into that field?
Yeah, well, I just got offered a job really at Longman Higher Education doing book covers, and just started doing higher education books, and did that for about 3.5 years out in Harlow, and then sort of got a bit bored with that, to be fair, and got a big break at Random House, where I started doing the bestsellers and things like that. And
then that's quite a transition, there, isn't it?
Yes, it was my big break, and suddenly I was in at the deep end trying to do covers for Stephen Fry and things like that, and I was like, oh my God, I've only done engineering books before this. yeah, a big step.
Was it hard from a sort of design point of view, though, to go from, because I worked in nonfiction when I worked in publishing, and I know that, you know, there's much more sort of specific about what the expectations are in terms of book covers, to go from that to having, I imagine, greater freedom?
Yes, I mean, greater freedom, much more pressure, not really understanding the language that they were talking about, not really understanding the genres. Yeah, it was hard work, but I absolutely loved it. It was a proper big job in the doing titles that you'd see posters on the tube, and dealing with the big stars. It was fantastic.
That pressure of working in a bigger organization where the stakes are so high, I had some experience of it with the BBC, in the sense that we're on a really big money event or piece of coverage, you can almost feel there's electricity in a meeting room where everyone's terrified of being the person who makes the mistake that costs the money. Is that the same in publishing?
Yeah, I think that's the thing that sort of slows it all down, and you get stuck in the mud where, say we're doing a biography, we all know we're going to stick a picture of the fella's face on the front, and then we're going to have some type on it. And that seems too simple, really, and it could be done within about a week or less, and yet 6 months later we still haven't got a cover.
I can relate to that, because I do remember at Oxford University Press, very similar sort of we'd have the meeting, we used to call it the jackets meeting.
Yes.
And they were both very exciting and very stressful, and I remember that our designer, he stood at the front and he was about to reveal his cover, and I could see the fear on his face. It was like facing the lions of the sales team.
Yes, I had that every Tuesday morning at Simon & Schuster, where I was art director there for 6.5 years. And I would invite the whole, 20 odd people would be in that room in the boardroom. And I'd invite my designers in there as well. And I would print out each cover and then actually wrap it on physical books and then put them on a bookcase at the end of the room. And there would be the, oh, wow, yeah, really like that. And then by the end of that conversation, 10 minutes later, they decided not to choose any of them. Because people sort of, they talk themselves out of it. It's easier to say no than to just immediately go for something.
I've noticed that in these sort of meetings where there's a feeling that everyone has a feeling they've got to contribute.
Yes.
Whether it's positive or negative, they cannot be seen to be silent. And therefore, and the mood of a room can be changed in an instant. One person can have undue influence on the outcome. Yes. It's an extraordinary dynamic. I have to say, one of the reasons that we're doing what we're doing now, and why I wanted to be part of this Hoback thing, was to get away from that level of committee structure. And I remember being in meetings. Sorry about the digression and sort of talking about my career, but. For anyone who's seen the series W1A about the BBC.
Oh, yeah, I've seen a little bit of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I went through so many meetings in that building that were like that, where people they were so afraid of being the one that got it wrong or whatever it was, or they had to have some say, that you go around in circles. And sometimes I would just bang the desk and go, whatever sake. Can we not just agree that it's called this, and that we're going to use this word to describe what we're discussing. You just want to clash heads together. I bet that was one of the frustrations, wasn't it, for you?
Yes, I mean, what would happen, as I say, everybody would be excited about the covers, and then say, but could we see it with, you know, some red type instead of the blue or whatever? Okay, so you'd come back next week and you'd put the red type on. And then next week, oh, can we see it with a slightly bigger? And then sort of 3 weeks later, they got a bit bored with it. That big starburst quality about it anymore. And it was just, oh, right, now we're a bit bored with this now. So, and then it gets rejected. And you think, well, you liked it 3 weeks ago, so I'm going to talk yourselves out of it. But the real reason behind that might be that the author hasn't actually finished it. Or, you know, they're thinking of shifting it. And then they just string the design team along for another few
months. Right. Be, yeah.
Yeah. So is that one of the reasons that you've gone down this sort of consultancy and solo route, you know, working in your own environment as opposed to in that bigger organization?
Yeah, I mean, things like that. I mean, yeah, the politics of any big corporate organization kind of gets to you after a while. But yeah, I mean, that's the upside is, you know, there's being self-employed, you know, there's a few meetings and you know, you've got your freedom of your own work schedule. And yeah, there's more design time as well, because when I was art director, I had a team of designers, I had being meetings a lot of the time, and I still kept designing during that period, but it was always trying to find room to do that and trying to push meetings away rather than, yeah, trying to create a bit of space for myself to just shut the door and design.
That leads us on nicely, actually. One of the questions we wanted to ask you is for our listeners and for us, well, actually our personal curiosity, if we were to play through the keyhole and we were walking into your working environment, what does it look like? What does a book designer's, or what does your environment look like?
Well, I'm so pleased we haven't got the video on here. My room is the most untidy thing. I'm so embarrassed by it. I don't know why. I just can't get around to tidying it up. I don't know. There's loads of stuff on the walls that I just, oh, that's a good little visual thing. And I'll keep that there. And I don't know. The next job seems more important than sorting any old toot out.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. I just sooner sit and design something than be very organized, and I'm embarrassed about it, really.
I don't think you should be embarrassed, because I think that's part of the creative brain, isn't it? It's not a very ordered, logical thing.
No, I mean, I'm the same. I'm, you know, actually, we've just had that opportunity by moving the office and the house together just a few weeks ago to strip away a lot of the collected crud that was surrounding us, and we were in a higgledy-piggledy 17th century farmhouse, low beams, everything seemed to be sort of crushing in on us, and not much storage. We've got less storage here, but somehow I'm working better in a slightly more organized environment. But nonetheless, my natural instinct is to pile up books and just leave things where I leave them, you know.
And yes. Unfortunately, so is mine. Yes. Put together. Lots of piles.
All three of us shouldn't be together. Because I'm the same. I'm just a hoarder, I think. And but I've got a dedicated office away from the rest of the flat, so that helps, because that's where I work, and then I can leave it and walk upstairs and, you know, do some lunch or something. So.
Do you have a view of across London or anything romantic like that? What's
well, from the rest of the flat I do, but not from this room. It just looks out into the downstairs flat's garden. And I keep the blind down because you can't see the screen very well, so with reflections. So.
Oh, we're getting the picture.
Yes.
No, oh, that was the cat coming through the cat flap.
Yeah, it has to make an appearance in every episode.
I mean, the way you're talking about your, you know, you've been working with covers for a very long time. I mean, I don't want to make you feel old, but yeah. You must have an idea now. What makes a good cover? What would you say is like the perfect book cover?
Yeah. I don't know whether anything's a perfect book cover, but I think it needs to be. I can hear your cat there.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I always think designing book covers is it's like telling an old joke a new way. So we've all seen a blooded dagger on a cover a thousand times, but you know, can you do that can you tell that same old joke in a new way? Can you, you know, shoot it with sort of upmarket photography or do something with the type, get the image to interact with the type or something like that? So as I say, it's that old gag, but yeah, in a fresh approach, really. That's what I think often we're trying to aim for as cover.
Yeah, but if you look at the evolution of covers and the revolution that the creation of paperbacks, say, had with Penguin Classics, as they are now, but that sort of uniform thing, the only thing that really differentiated a cover, apart from the title, obviously, was the colour. So green for whatever it was, literature, or blue for something you might learn from it, that kind of thing. We've come a long way since then.
Back then it was just, all right, yeah, as you say, a colour would show which category it was in, and then it was just a question of putting a bit of type on it. Back in the Jan Schick old days, I think he was a typographic designer back then in Penguin. But yeah, I think we're always looking for something originality, a clever hook or a graphic device. I think that's what we're trying to do. But you're trying to make something look appealing. I remember an old college lecturer of mine said, graphic design is making things look good. You know, it can be as simple as that.
Mm. Yeah, I think sometimes people overcomplicate it and overthink it, don't they? In any sort of design. Oh, cat.
This is the most important part of the interview. We're really learning something here, Aki. We don't need to hear from you, okay?
Yeah.
That's taught us. Yeah,
it can be as simple as that, really. And yeah, along with that, you know, that's the most important. It's got to look good. But, you know, along with that, if you could have a really clever idea as well, or a little gag, a little hook. I remember doing sort of Shopaholics, for instance, back in the day. And the visual gag each time on those was the character had gone out and she'd bought too much shopping. She'd gone out to the shops and she'd bought too many bags. So yeah, I'd got all these shopping bags on top of Shopaholic, it goes to New York. And so you got all these shopping bags on top of the New York cab, but there's way too many of them. So the gag each time was she'd gone out and she bought too much, too many. She'd gone out and she'd bought too much. And that's all it is. It's quite simple.
Yeah.
But it's a neat little thing. It doesn't need.
And it's very effective because I can picture that cover because I've got that book somewhere.
Right.
It's stuck in my memory.
Yeah. And then the other one was, I think, Shopaholic Ties the Knot. So we had a picture of the two characters on a wedding cake, and the bride has got the groom holding all her bags that she's gone out shopping, and she bought too many again. You know, it's just, that's the gag. It's quite simple.
We're talking about simplicity in those, you know, conveying those images and catching the eye and being memorable. But there's so much. I mean, we've had discussions. Yeah, Rebecca, yourself, and myself, we've talked about, if we think about the titles that we're talking about, we've got 6 books, 2 to come out and 4 out there already. We're talking about Lewis Hastings' Quartet of Thrillers and Malcolm Hollingdrake's forthcoming Mersey Side crime series. But when we've discussed it and you're taking a brief from us, there's a lot of information and aspects that we're discussing here. You know, we've got genre expectations, we've got trying to, you know, decide where the balance is between the title of the book, the strength of the way that the author's name is presented, you know, terms of color themes as well, all sorts of things. You know, there are a myriad of things that can complicate the process. So how do you sift through that and eventually present images back to us?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you talk about the hierarchy of the information is important. You know, if we can establish, okay, you know, is the author a big superstar name? Yeah, okay, then, well, that's number one. That's your hierarchy information. That's the author's name is number one. Number two is going to be probably the title, and, you know, strap lines and quotes and things thereafter. But to establish that, to understand that is important, isn't it? And, you know, what genre is it? know, I could make a Jackie Collins as a sort of discipline, as a bit of an exercise. I could make a Jackie Collins look like an Andy McNab if you want. Yeah.
I'd like to see.
Yeah. You know, it's just that same graphic language, isn't it? So, you know, we could have explosions and men jumping through windows with guns and things, and the sort of treatment you would do on Andy McNab type, you know, you could do that on a Jackie Collins or a chick flick, but you confuse the reader. You wouldn't the reader would be, oh no, anyway, I need to see, I expect that kind of graphic language. That's what I'm used to. It's the same with cereal packaging or something like that. You know, you expect Kellogg's cornflakes to look a certain way. You don't want to confuse it with something else. It's just, it's the same. It's a graphic language. That's
one thing you said a moment ago, when you were discussing how you used to present at Simon & Schuster on a Tuesday morning in the boardroom, and you do a mock-up of a physical copy of the book with the cover design on it. One thing we wanted to ask you was, things have changed somewhat in the digital first publication market, which is growing and growing. The thumbnail is all important, as opposed to how it will look on a shelf. How much has that changed your art and the way that you have to think about things?
Not much, really. It really hasn't. And a lot of people ask that same question, because you think, oh, well, you know, it's only a little digital thing on an Amazon page. But that the same principles should be true. So if you're putting up a cover, a physical cover, at the end of a boardroom, the sales guy at the other end of that room, if he can't see it, if he can't work out what's going on at that distance, that's the same principle.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, yeah, I must admit, I would have expected there to be more of a change because of the digital side. But yeah,
it's that same principle. You know, if he's looking at it and he's thinking, oh, what is that? Is that a giraffe? And no, it's not a giraffe. It's a curtain. You know, something. All right. Oh, well, clearly it doesn't work then, you know, because it's not clear enough and you can't read the type. Because I've always worked in the kind of more mass market side of things, and so everything had to work for supermarkets and a mass market kind of approach, and so you had to be really disciplined about getting type up big and really easy to read and all those kind of things. And that's hard work. It looks easy, it looks a bit naff sometimes, but that's harder than the upmarket literary fiction, often, not always, but because you can be quite delicate with that, you know, be quite subtle and all that looks very, very nice. And it doesn't look commercial, but that's, you know, it looks tasteful. But to do like the mass market stuff you're going to get in the supermarkets, yeah, you have to be a bit more ballsy about it, really.
So, I mean, one thing that we're talking about is the sort of genre expectations, the expectations of how the font, or what sort of fonts are used for certain genres. When I worked in publishing, we used to have different covers for the UK market and the US market. I don't think we ever had the same cover for both. And I just wanted to ask you, has that changed over time at all? You know, and is it the same? Because that was in nonfiction. I wonder whether, is it the same in fiction? I remember Harry Potter had different covers for UK and US.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, when I worked at Simon & Schuster, you know, Simon & Schuster, US is much bigger than it is in the UK. And yeah, we were taking on a lot of their covers coming in, and we would often recover them because, yeah, the aesthetic between the US and the UK is quite different. I think it's merging a little bit more, but I always looked at the US covers and I always thought the designers have been a bit lazy there, because they would stick everything, all the type in a box, and then they'd run that over the image. And you could always tell a US cover because that was the way they did it. And you think, oh, that's easy, isn't it? Because a lot of the time, getting type to read over an image is quite difficult. And people don't understand the principles of that, how that works. And so the easiest way of getting out of it is just to stick it in a box. And so, yeah, I was sort of being a bit lazy. But you could always, that was always something that sort of made them distinctive. And you think, oh, yes, the US cover. They'd often say a novel as well.
Just in case there's ambiguity there.
Yeah, definitely a novel.
That challenge of interpreting a brief, though, I mean, you've obviously got hundreds of credits to your name and many, many designs under your belt. But do you ever feel a sense of trepidation when you submit your first designs to a client?
Yeah. I mean, I I'll design a lot of terms designing on a job all day, and I'll think, oh, that's good, that's going really well, it's going really well. I'll send it in. And I've made that mistake a few times, and I'm very disciplined about it now, and I won't. And I'll say, yeah, I'm really pleased with this on the Tuesday. And then come the sort of Wednesday morning or Wednesday afternoon, I look at it again before sending it in. I think, oh, good, I'm glad I didn't do that, because look, the type's way too close to the edge or something, you know, something quite easily recognisably wrong with it. And you think, oh, right, I can adjust that. And then those steady improvements as you go through, and you can't, often when you're too close to it, you can't see the wood for the trees, you know, getting a bit of distance away from it is a good thing. And then coming back to it and making sort of slight improvements each time, that seems to work.
We do a similar thing. So when we get a cover from a designer, look at it, we have an impression, and then I always say, right, I'm going to close it, I'm not going to think about it, and I'll have another look tomorrow morning and see what I think, you know, because you do, you have that sort of initial impact can be different.
Yes.
For the following day. So I agree.
I try and sort of, I not cover my back, but obviously I don't want everything, I don't want it all to be rejected. I want them to sort of feel there's something there. And so I often do quite a few visuals. So I might do, you know, 6 or 8 or something. And I want to be happy with them. I think everything I submit as a visual is a cover. You know, it's a usable cover. It's up to the client whether they choose it or not. I'll never submit something I just think it just doesn't work at all. I mean, it's like a builder trying to build a wall and he knows it's not straight. You know, I wouldn't do that. It's sometimes, especially when it's a new client, I'm trying to put a bit more effort in to impress them.
It's a bit like us when we take on another author. It takes time sometimes to develop a sort of an understanding and communication. And that must be the case when you take on a new client, to understand and interpret what they're trying to tell you.
Yeah, I think, you know, a new client might often just send me an email, oh, you know, we've got this job, would you be interested? And, you know, I'll read the brief, and then I often want to chat to them about it as well to fully understand, because there's always a few questions that they probably haven't made clear in the brief. Character descriptions are sometimes to be avoided, but, you know, if they're saying, right, okay, we need a woman on the front, well, okay, can you give us an idea of how old she is, or, you know, tall, or, I think you spend a lot of time putting a picture of a woman on the front. Oh no, she's not like that. Yes.
Did I say woman? I meant child.
Yeah, I think what I was trying to say is that I think a lot of the publishers have been doing it for years, you know, the standard man walking away in moody landscape. The more the big publishers do that, the easier it is for the self-published sort of DIY person to copy it, because it's such a standard format. So they end up copying that reasonably successfully, but there's certain bits of how it's executed that they never really understand. Some of it is typography, and I like to think typography is dangerous in the wrong hands. because we're all used to seeing professional typography everywhere. And so when it's poorly executed, it stands out like a sore thumb. And often as someone who hasn't been doing it for a while, they won't know what's wrong with it. And there's, you know, there is a discipline to it all. And it's just little things like getting type to read out of a background. You know, so type reads what we call reads on or reads out of. And so it's either light type on a dark background or dark type on a light background. Now, occasionally you can mix the two, but you have to be very in control of that background. I remember a lot of designers who came to me when I was running the Simon Schuster department. You know, they wouldn't understand that why didn't my type read? Well, because you haven't made your mind up, or whether it's reading out or even reading on. And that goes back when I first started doing this at Longman, we were drawing the books on a drawing board, literally, before we had computers. So we had to overlay sheets, and you had to write instructions to the printer. Right, this, and it was just pieces of black type. and you had to, a tracing paper sheet would go over the top of it, and you'd have to write on that instructions to the printer. This piece of type prints 100% cyan, 30% magenta, 10% yellow. And someone out in the printer would have to put all this thing together. So we had to make decisions without actually seeing it on screen.
Mm. And so things have changed quite a lot in those terms then, because now what you see on the screen
is what you get. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's WYSIWYG now, as they say. But that was but back then we had to do it all on a drawing board, and you just had to kind of imagine it.
Yeah. Well, no, I have some sympathy for that, because back in my day when I started in broadcasting, first of all in radio, it was reel-to-reel tapes, like the machines that you used to see at the beginning of Mission Impossible in the 60s were the sort of machines I used to carry out into the field. And you had a 15-minute long two reels of tape spooling onto each other. Mm. And to edit that would take a physical, I'd use a cutthroat razor blade and a China graph pencil to mark up where it was. And if you got it wrong, you made the edit in the wrong place, it was in the wastebasket, and you had to get it back out and tape it together and hope that you could correct your issue. So there was that sense of, you never quite knew what, when you make committed yourself to the decision, if it was going to work. Even worse in television, which was incredibly long-winded, and I managed to miss out on the period when everything was shot on film, but even on videotape it took forever to do the sort of process. So in a sense, technology has made it much, much quicker.
Yes.
But at the same time, I guess there is a danger that with all these new options and facilities and things that you can do there and then, that actually you can blind yourself and confuse yourself with the amount of options that you've now got.
Well, the client is aware of that as well. So they're constantly asking for changes. And you think, you know, back in the day, that would have had to get an airbrush guy in to change that sky. And he would literally, you know, he'd be all right, oh, we've got to wait a couple of weeks for that. Oh, yeah.
But now you can just have a fiddle on the computer in 5 seconds later. There you go. How about that sky?
That's right. Yeah. So it's great, but it's sort of kind of devalued it a little bit. You know, it's kind of, it's all done a bit too quick and cheap, really.
Yeah, because those skills, they get lost, don't they? Those skills that people had in the past.
Yeah.
A bit like you with your razor blade.
Well, I think it's not so much the skills, it's the philosophy behind why you do things a certain way, and that discipline you're talking about. That goes out the window when you can tinker.
Yeah, exactly. And often, you know, a client might say, oh, can we see that type in yellow? And I'll think, no, you won't be able to read it. And I'll tell them, you won't be able to read it, but can we just see it? Oh, you're right, you can't read it very well. I know that.
I think sometimes people have to have that say themselves, even though it's obvious.
Yes. The other thing often people look at on screen is, when you're working on screen, you're looking at light coming at you. But when that transfers to paper, that white screen, that light, is now just your paper. So what you can often see very well on screen won't necessarily print very well. A lot of people were designing, you know, terms of RGB, and they'll think, oh, that green looks really great. Time you change that to CMYK, like printing, it's gone really dull, isn't it? Yeah. You know, you're looking at how bright is your white piece of paper versus the light that's coming off your bright screen. That's the difference.
And that's one of the key elements and skills and judgments that you bring to your craft. But in terms of that client relationship, I mean, you must have, I don't know, I'm guessing here, dozens of examples of times when you've really felt like pulling, you know, Jen Butcher hair out over the way a job is going and the way that the client is directing you.
Well, you know, if it goes like that these days, if they ask me to do another job, I just put the price up.
Brilliant.
That's why it went up.
Oh, you guys are really good to work with. It's
very sweet of you. We try.
Going back to the sort of DIY cover singers, a little note I made to myself, that often a sort of, maybe a self-published author, for instance, will try and shoehorn three ideas into one cover, and it only really needs one, and you can sort of, and the idea will be, and from publishers it will be, oh yeah, can we have this and can we have that, and you think, no, we'll have just one idea and I can get that to work, but three is, yeah, there's not a lot of room for much else. Because every cover has the author's name, the title, and the image. They're the three elements, really.
And I think sometimes people make the mistake that they need to tell the story through one image.
Yeah.
And they're trying too hard. Cause, you know,
yeah.
But you know, this happens and this happens and this happens, and that's not conveyed in the book. Or it goes from London to New York to yes. Paris.
Yeah, we've had those debates. it has to be said. But I think what I respect, you know, when we've worked with you, and you have warned us, and you know, because you know, we want, part of our philosophy at Hoback is to empower our authors to have you know, probably greater say in the process than almost any other publisher out there gives them. And with it, you know, with that philosophy, there are times when that can be detrimental to the you know, the process, or it can deflect the true path towards a good cover, say, or the blurb, or whatever it might be. We still feel that's important, but that's not necessarily a useful approach to the creative process from, say, your perspective.
But it can be. I mean, for instance, that job I've just done for you, Sin, is it?
Sin, yeah.
Yeah, I think the author suggested he'd taken a picture of this scarecrow. The scarecrow looked very realistic, and I snuck it into the job, and there's something about it that makes it really, really scary, because it's not a scarecrow like Wurzel Gummidge kind of scarecrow. Yeah, it's a scarecrow with a kind of builder's sort of workman's Lumo jacket on, and it's just something that really eerie about it. I put it into the landscape, and it's just, I don't know, I just think it works really well. Now, you know, you sort of automatically think, oh, author's homemade photograph is going to look a bit naff, it's going to be a bit poor. The quality of it wasn't very good, but somehow, you know, you stick it into the landscape and you make it work. Mm. And yeah, so sometimes, you know, people come up with suggestions and think the automatic knee-jerk reaction is to sort of poo-poo it, but actually, you know, give it a go, it might work, you know, and it did, and yeah, it's a strange one.
Yeah, and it is a really strong cover. So for those of you listening to this interview, go to our website and have a look at the covers. We're going to put a little gallery together to accompany this interview, the ones that you've done for us. Mm-hmm. And indeed, we'll obviously direct them to your website, where there's an absolute, I remember when we first discovered you, Jen, we found your website and looked at your sort of your CV, if you like, visual CV, blown away by the variety. So, you know, there's a number of chick lit books there. Sophie Kinsella, I think, is in amongst them. And then there's biographies. There's a brilliant one that I think is iconic in recent biographies of people. It's the Pelé.
Oh, the image. Pelé one. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, if your breadth of sort of genres and approach to the job is breathtaking, frankly. And I would recommend everyone listening to this to go to Jem's website and have a look, because it really is, well, it's a feast for the eyes, really. It's really interesting having this conversation about all the thinking and the elements that go together in your process, delivering, you know, for your clients. Do you ever get a day where you think, oh, not again, I'm not another commission for a girl in a red coat, yeah, walking into the distance, yeah, in a wild landscape?
Yeah, and I'm getting a bit tired of those, but I don't turn them away. I've never really turned down a job. So, but yeah, you sort of think, okay, this is what the client wants. Okay, let's understand it. It's a kind of copycat cover, say, but let's realize what it is, and you know, let's not pretend we want something that is pretty standard. We and then try and also reinvent the wheel within it. It's there's get in and get out, I think, when it's a sort of standard job like that. But having said that, there's always something to do. There's always that little bit of challenge for me to oh, is there something I can do with a type? Is there, I mean, we're going to talk about typography, hopefully. And, you know, is there a little hook I can use? Is there an O that I can put a bullet hole in? I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but, you know, we often do it. Is there a descender on an R that I can turn into a devil's tail or something like that? You know, you've got, always got to look for things to do with the type. I think I often look at film posters, actually. They're good because the film poster designers, if I wasn't doing this, I'd like to do that. Because often, yeah, I mean, that would be a good challenge for me, actually, to see typography as opportunities, not to, you know, you've got to use it, you've got to make it work hard, really. Because, you know, the DIY designers just think that they've chosen a typeface and they think that's enough and they just stick it on there and let go of the wheel kind of thing. No, you've got to work with it. You've got to understand. I mean, often people say, well, what have you been working on today? I can't remember the title, although I've been looking at it all day long. I can't remember what it was called. I really can't. And because I'm not looking at the words, I'm looking at shapes and making things work. You know, I'm not reading it as a word.
No, so it's basically an art form, isn't it? You're creating something. So this is a bit of a sort of a throwaway question, but, you know, everybody has one of these, don't they? What's your favourite font?
I thought you might ask that. I don't really have one, but I have thought about this, and I'm into a font called Bliss at the moment, which is it. I think fonts are, an old tutor of mine said, fonts are really easy. You know, there's only three of them. All right, yeah. So it's sans serif, serif, and script. They're the sort of three, and there's loads of subsets of that, and there are thousands of different fonts. So, you know, don't misunderstand that. But it's what you do with them. That's the key to it. Yeah. So currently, I'm into this thing called Bliss. It's just a sans serif font, and there's loads of weights to it, so you can play around with different weights and things like that. The serif one I use a lot is Serlio, which is really kind of spiky and it's got a lot of character to it.
I'm putting these down. I'm going to have a play with them in a minute.
No, I quite like that idea, though, of a font having a personality. So you have a spiky font, you have a romantic font, would be a very sort of soft focus.
God, yeah, yeah. I mean, this is what it's all about. And the script one I use a lot. It's like a bog standard sort of starting point for each of these. So I don't spend a lot of time thinking, oh, which font to use, which one. I'm just thinking, oh, it's all right, okay, this is a mass market thriller. Okay, so it's probably going to be a sans serif here. Okay, well, let's start with Bliss. And then if that's something, and then start working with it, start drawing over the top of it, distressing it, those kind of things. The other thing you see a lot is a distressed font that is a bought distressed font. And there's kind of nothing wrong with that. But if you're seeing sort of supposed accidental distressing, and then you're seeing that on one particular letter, say, and it's repeated like six times, then it's pretty obvious that that's not what it's trying to be, something that isn't. Yeah, try and do your own distressing on the type.
This is the cat saying should draw this to a close. Jem, thanks so much for taking us into your world and spending some time with us. And I'm sure everyone listening to the Hobcast will learn an enormous amount. And long may you have that enthusiasm, because I know we'll be working with you in the years to come. But for now, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking me.
I say this every week. There is so much to take from the interviews that we get from the people we speak to, whether it's Matt Bird or Linda Huber, Wendy Turbin. You know, all the people that we've spoken to so far have pushed our knowledge along and taken us into their world and given us the time on the Hobcast to pass on some great information. And there's tons there, again, from Jem about the art of cover design, the frustrations, the great bits,
the good, the bad, the ugly,
and the philosophy that a great cover and the methodology. And I love all the thoughts about, essentially, if you boil it down, it's an image, it's some typography, you know, that's and a color scheme, and that's basically a cover. But then there's so much more to it, and I think he described that brilliantly.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting, isn't it? You're saying it's actually quite simple on the one side, but it's very complicated on the other. And that actually makes sense, that it can be both at the same time.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we have taken a cover from him or had the, as he mentioned, 6 to 8 designs that he would send on, and we spend time with it and go, right, love the typography on 3, image balance is right on 5, not sure about the colours on 6, but if we bled those into 7, then, you know, and that's the sort of debate that you have. And we are thrilled with the covers that we've had, and indeed thrilled with the covers we get from Jane as well, our other designer, Jane Mapp.
Jane Mapp. So, yeah, so far we've used 2 cover designers, Jem, but Jane Mapp also, who she's designed the likes of Daria's Daughter and Blood Loss and
Over Her Dead Body, Hunted, yeah, and the Rock series with Robert Dawes. So yeah, it is, you know, it's great seeing the two talents at work and the different approaches and the different outcomes. But covers are so important, and we've spent so much time thinking about them, and we're delighted with the results. We really are. And I think we, you know, as that relationship deepens with both of them, it's actually easier to come up with the sort of designs that you're hoping for. With Jem, we've got something else under commission, which we'll tell you about in a later episode of the podcast, for a book that should be coming out in June. Looking forward to that, but we'll keep that secret for a moment. But there's so much there. So look at the images on our website, www.hobeck.net. at the podcast section, and we'll have the gallery of the images that he's created, which are fantastic. But you asked a question at the end there, what's your favourite font? And he came up with, I think, Bliss was his favourite.
That's right, he did, yes.
What's yours?
I quite like Helvetica.
I was going to say that.
Oh, no, I don't know why. I mean, I find it hard to explain why, because I go on gut feeling quite a lot with anything visual, and I just like it.
Yeah, I to be honest, I'm not a font of knowledge on these things. One I don't like when I'm writing. I like it nice and clean. I use Arial most of the time when I'm writing on a word processor. I just like it nice and clean. It springs out on the screen, and there's no ambiguity with Arial. But Times New Roman, which is one of the most popular fonts in the world. Standard practice, you know, basically you open a Word document, it offers you Times New Roman, doesn't it, most of the time, or used to. I'm not that fond of it. I know it goes into a lot of fiction books as well, and it's particularly popular in non-fiction. You'd be able to tell me if that's correct or not.
Not possibly traditionally, but I'm with you on that. I've never been a fan of Times New Roman.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I went through a process before I left the BBC. The BBC decided that they had to have their own font, and it's called Reith, after Lord Reith, the first Director General of the BBC. And they had, you know, Reith, Sans-Serif or Sans-Serif, and bold and italicised and all that sort of thing. And it was to save them money. So by getting someone to design a new font for the BBC, but no one's using it. We were all told to use it in our emails, but no one bothered. We all had our favourites. And I don't think the website's using it yet. Graphics are supposed to use it on television. And it's all there to save money, because you basically license fonts if you're a big organisation like that. And it was a money-saving idea. And also someone's idea of creating a stronger brand image. Much like when the BBC used to have slanty, italicised blobs for the BBC logo.
I remember that.
Yeah, and then they went square, and that was a massive controversy. And they're talking about changing it again. And indeed, get this, and you'll be surprised, right? BBC Sport, the colour scheme for BBC Sport Productions, the basic thing in the website and everything, is yellow background, black type.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Very familiar.
Right. And then they decided that there were so many different yellows being used, roughly the same, but nonetheless not inconsistent, they decided to have a BBC Yellow created. BBC Sport. I mean, it cost an absolute fortune to have it changed. So, for instance, where I used to work on the ground floor of the sports newsroom in Salford, There's a TV studio right in the middle. So all of our desks were sort of surrounding this TV studio. You see it if you're in the UK, and indeed if you're around the world, you see it on BBC World. And it has a halo around the top, a lit halo, which the name's BBC Sport, you know, and yellow and black and backlit, which is shown on a wide shot. But that itself probably cost £25,000 to change. So for all you license fee payers out there...
That's what you're paying for.
That's what you're paying for. And it's painful, really. You know, I'm much more of the... If it's good enough, let's just, you know, accept it.
What I love about big organisations like that, though, is the amount of meetings they would probably have had to discuss the exact shade of yellow and how to implement the...
Oh, boy, did they. Did they ever. Went on for months. And in fact, the person who decided what shade of yellow it was... went off to the private sector literally a week later.
Left their legacy of yellow.
Yeah, exactly. Go figure. And of course, not being there to drive it through, it's kind of withered on the vine a bit. Anyway, I digress. Listen, it's been wonderful to have your company this week. Thanks you again for joining us on the Hobcast. I keep saying this and I keep stumbling over the website. So I'm going to ask you to say it this time.
So www.hobeck.net
is the home of Hobeck Books. So much there. The podcast is there. The blog is there. Our shop is there. And there's obviously a lot of other material on that website. Go to that and use Hobcast20 to get your discount on paperback books. The rest of our titles are in Kindle Unlimited and on Amazon, wherever you are in the world. So please check out our 11 titles to date. But thank you for your company. And next week, our guest is a number one selling author, Matt Brolly, who I've narrated for in the past, one of the best crime writers in the UK, and back at number one again with his latest book, The Gorge, which came out last week. So he'll be telling us about his journey to number one, Matt Brolly. But for now, from us at Hobeck Books, Rebecca and Adrian, thank you and have a great week.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.